Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is, for the very first time, Sasha Bonser, Boat International's Editorial Director. Sasha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Stu. It's really great to be here, and what a cool week to be on it as well, with all our oceans content all over the place.
That's right, this week it's all been about World Oceans Day, and to celebrate we have run a great week of content, stories and discussions across all our platforms in partnership with the Ocean Family Foundation, a group of yacht owners who support ocean conservation efforts. A little later in this podcast you can hear Senior Editor Sophia Wilson's interview with Joss Kent, CEO of luxury travel company And Beyond, and Dr. Tessa Hempson, Oceans Without Borders Program Manager and Principal Scientist. Joss and Tessa help shed a little light on what responsible tourism really means and how the superyacht industry can learn from And Beyond's journey. And we've learned a lot as a company. At Boat International, we've come a long way in the last decade when it comes to conservation and the focus on ocean health. Sasha and I both joined Boat actually way back, it seems a long time ago now, in 2014. And the company didn't have much of a focus on the oceans, but that all changed with the launch of the Ocean Awards, which was actually your brainchild, Sasha. So why don't you tell us a bit more about the start of Ocean Awards?
Well, it was indeed. And like you say, it feels ancient now, but actually the Ocean Awards has been going for 6 years. And the idea behind it was really an acknowledgement really early on of how extraordinary our audience is, not only in terms of, you know, the breadth and experience and proximity to all things to do with the sea, but also their devotion and passion when it comes to helping protect it for generations to come. And so I did a little bit of research to look at how we could celebrate people who were doing, you know, the best things to protect it. And the charity that kept popping up is called the Blue Marine Foundation, and they're a UK-based charity, and they've spent decades establishing marine protected areas all over the world. So I sort of cold called their executive chairman, Charles Clover, and we got together to see what we could do, because obviously they have the credibility, the scientists, the outreach, the stuff that we don't have at Boat, and nor would we, and just to see whether we could build a bit of a bridge and, you know, tell fantastic stories, because I knew that our audience would be eternally kind of interested in them. So we launched the awards. There's around 7 or 8 categories every year that range from science to innovation to public awareness to local hero. And over the years, we've gathered some fantastic partners along the way in different capacities. There's Fishmongers Hall, Arxen, Crystal Caviar, and through again brilliant sort of roster of judges who have been incredibly loyal. Actually, it's one of the most enjoyable parts of it is the judging lunch. Around 12 people get together, ranging from boat owners to scientists to people who are incredibly engaged, either because they're owners or they work in the industry in some way. And there's always a very spirited lunch, and there's always an incredible sort of lineup of nominations, and at the end of it we come up with 12 winners or so, and then we publish their stories across our channels, across Blue's channels, and it's really exciting that the nominations grow every year. So I mean, if you know anyone who could be nominated, please do send them to boatinternational.com/oceanaward. It's a really fantastic initiative and we're all really proud of it.
That's right, nominations for next year are open now. Can you pick a highlight from this year? Who was your favourite winner from this year?
My favourite, it's usually the same category every year. It's called the Local Hero Award, and it is what it says on the tin. It celebrates a person who has sort of championed a local community initiative. This year it was somebody called Naomi Longa, who was from Papua New Guinea, and she set up something called the Sea Women of Melanesia, which teaches women to snorkel and scuba dive, but also trains them in conservation theory. And through these women, a number of MPAs, marine protected areas, have been established around Papua New Guinea, and fantastic sort of initiatives and education have sprung up around it. And she's such an inspiring woman. There's a fantastic video of her on the website. But it's a really, I think this category always sort of pulls on my heartstrings the most, because it's always a very emotional story. And it's always somebody who has, you know, fought against the odds in a very, very local way, way to do something really staggering, proportionate to the community and the sort of lack of resource they usually have. And in the past, actually, one of the judges has sort of dug into his pockets just because he's so moved too and awarded the local hero. And sometimes it's so hard we end up sort of giving it to two or three because we can't actually, even these judges who usually are a very opinionated bunch, just cannot choose one. But sometimes they get rewarded because the judges are just so moved by it. So that's always my favourite. And again, this year it was again.
Yeah, I agree. That's always the most kind of tear-jerking, emotional, inspirational one, the Local Hero Award. I love those stories. And from there, we went on to create Ocean Talks, which is usually a brilliant day of discussion at the Royal Geographical Society in London. But of course, COVID put paid to that this year. So that inspired this kind of week-long celebration, really, of the oceans with all the things we've put together. So on Monday, it all kicked off with a four-way Instagram Live, the first four-way Instagram Live we've ever done, and it went without any major disasters, which was a huge relief. That featured Andrew Winch, Peter Lurson and Jonathan Beckett, three super yachting grandees. They discussed how the super yacht industry is changing to leave as little impact as possible. On Tuesday, we launched a really beautifully shot and edited and produced short film featuring some key innovators in the sector. On Wednesday, we staged a clubhouse discussion. Lily Barkley, Ben Fogel, the TV presenter, and others about the scourge of ocean plastics and the steps we can all take to minimise our plastic use and waste. And on Thursday, we had some great tips from brokerage company Fraser. They have an in-house green team, which promotes environmental practices. They gave some tips on how yacht owners, charter guests and crew can minimise their environmental footprint. And the podcast kind of caps the week. But, you know, behind the scenes, it's not just about Ocean Talks or Ocean Awards. There's other initiatives we're involved with too. And one of the other ones, Sasha, that was another of your great ideas was Yachts for Science. Tell us about Yachts for Science.
Well, I shouldn't take the credit. It was very much a joint idea between us and our partners. But it is, dare I say, a brilliant idea because it's so simple, like so many brilliant ideas. And it's literally the creation of a sort of Tinder matchmaking service between scientists and yachts. And we realised, again, that our audience was the closest to the water, the most passionate about saving it. And time again, and I know you've heard this constantly, Stu, and I heard it constantly, which was this sort of frustration on behalf of various parts of the industry, from owner to broker to designer, that they really, really, really wanted to help. And on occasions, they just didn't know how to. It felt like an insurmountable sort of mass of issues that they didn't know where to start. And yet they felt that they really had something to offer. And then on the other side of it, through our Ocean Awards, through our sort of outreach programs, we were meeting and coming across scientists, videographers, NGOs who were working on these fantastic projects, but what they really needed more than anything was access to the sea, and that was where they kept, you know, coming a cropper. So the idea was quite simple, is quite simple: matchmake these two parties and, you know, find a way to get scientists, videographers, oceanographers, those people who don't have the cash, who do have the sort of passion and knowledge, to get them onto the sea so that they could do their research, and from that, of course, great things happen. But as I say, it was very much a joint idea, and I do have to name check our partners because they're all so brilliant and we're all doing it together. So the first one was Necton, which is a foundation that works to accelerate scientific exploration and protection of the ocean. They produce amazing films and they go deep onto the ocean seabed. They lobby governments. Then we also have Arxon, who are a fantastically innovative company that builds explorer yachts. EOS, who you know well and most of our audience do, which is of course the industry leader for planning, executing remote expeditions to every remote square millimetre of the world that you ever want to go to. And then of course Off, who we've just been talking about, who sponsor Ocean Talks and also are part of Yachts for Science. So we're all founding partners together and we're all coming together the whole time to work out how to push this message more and more. We've had one or two fantastic projects come off the ground already. The yachtsforscience.com website is full of scientists looking for access, and it's full of yachts saying, you know, we're going to the Mediterranean in the last 3 weeks of X. We have two spare berths. But the key, of course, is the actual matchmaking bit of it, just like Tinder. And that's where, you know, the work needs to be done. And we've made a really good start. But the more that people can sort of push scientists or yachts onto that site, the better.
Yeah, we need lots of yacht owners engaging with Yachts for Science, because you know, it's so often there's empty legs, or you know, there's a week where the owner's not on board, there's no charter guests available. You know, it's a great opportunity to kind of lend your boat to the cause, get a scientist on board, and actually really contribute to our understanding of the oceans.
And you've seen as well, Stu, I mean, a lot, I think this is a new thing, you can tell me, but it, you know, definitely in the last few years, I feel like quite a lot of charter guests and quite a lot of owners actually want to host the scientists. It's not, you know, they could lend their boat when it's empty. They could also host somebody, and then it's a whole educational week wherever they are around what's going on in the sea below them. And I think that's also a sort of growing trend, which is another thing Yachts for Science could facilitate.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially for owners with kids on board, it's a great way to get kids engaged with ocean health, and you know, bring them, you know, rub them right up against the science, and hopefully inspire a lifelong love of the oceans and protecting them. So that's Yachts for Science. It's all available on the website now, or yachtsforscience.com. Please do go check it out. In other news, I do have to mention the launch this week. It's been a busy week of boat business, the B2B, the business facing section of our website, boatinternational.com. So this is brand new area of the website entirely focused on the business of yachting. It's all about offering a new level of insight into an analysis of the super yacht market, and there's some great stories up already. But I was reading one this morning, and one stat really struck me when I was reading it. We all know about the roaring brokerage market currently. We've spoken at length about that, and the fact that half of all super yacht brokerage transactions this year have gone to US buyers. But the National Marine Manufacturers Association in the US has released a report about smaller boat sales in the US, from personal watercraft to fishing boats and dinghies and everything in between. So sales were up 14% across all categories in 2020, realizing a total value of 49.3 billion euros for the marine industry in the US, and the sector supports almost 700,000 jobs. But it's the next stat that really blew me away. The NMMA reckoned that there are 415,000 first-time buyers in the US last year alone. That's almost 500,000 people coming into boating for the first time ever, many of whom were driven by the simple desire to get out on the water, escape lockdown, etc. So there you go. The way I look at that in the context of our oceans theme podcast, that's almost 500,000 new people falling in love with the seas, lakes and oceans, rivers, and so 500,000 more people very engaged with protecting them as well. So obviously the data story this week as well concerns the most eco-friendly type of yachts out there, and they are of course sailing boats. So there's lots of really interesting fuel initiatives underway around the world, and obviously that was highlighted actually by Peter Lursen on Monday in our Instagram live, which is available now if you want to go look at it. So Lursen are building, or developing rather, a fuel cell super yacht currently, which is going to be, it's a fascinating project, and we'll be tracking it every step of the way. But sailing yachts, obviously, were flying the flag for eco-conscious yachtsmen, and have been for many, many years. They are definitely a niche part of the market. For example, of the 351 super yachts delivered in 2020, just 24 were sailing boats, and that was fairly consistent with 2019 and 2018. Meanwhile, of the 412 super yachts sold on the brokerage market last year, just 27 were sailing boats. For 2020, in fact, sailing boat yacht sales were down a bit on 2019, despite the success of the brokerage market overall. Meanwhile, if we look at the global order book of yachts in build or on order, it should give us a picture of sailing yacht numbers we can expect to see in coming years. According to the latest global order book, 59 super yacht sailers are in build or on order, which is 7.2% of all yachts in the global order book, and exactly the same figure as the one the year before. So that tells the picture of a fairly static sailing yacht market. But here's the really interesting thing. We've noticed in the figures, multi-hulls, sailing multi-hulls, are really having a moment, and 10 are expected for delivery in 2021. So multi-hulls are more efficient, they offer more volume, they're more stable, and it's not just on the sailing side. We're seeing more and more multi-hull power motor yachts, power catamarans being built all the time too. So as this trend grows, perhaps we'll see more of an exodus onto the multi-hull sailing side. We'll have to wait and see. Stay tuned for more on that. So Sash, it's been great to have you on the podcast this week.
Thanks, Stu. It's been fantastic. I think I should do it again.
I think you should, absolutely.
You should do, you're more very ocean welcome content all the time.
Yeah, you are welcome anytime. So that's it for this week. Stay tuned for Sophia Wilson's interview with Josh Kent and Dr. Tessa Hempson.
As a continuation of Boat International's Ocean Talks, sponsored and supported by the Ocean Family Foundation, I'm delighted to be joined by Joss Kent, CEO of luxury travel company And Beyond, and Dr. Tessa Hempson, Oceans Without Borders Programme Manager and Principal Scientist. Founded more than three decades ago, And Beyond operates with the dual aim of giving guests a luxury holiday experience in some of Africa's most remote landscapes, while also improving and enhancing the communities and environments in which they operate. As part of the company's mission, And Beyond, in collaboration with the Africa Foundation, created the Oceans Without Borders project in 2017 to help address the challenges facing the East African marine ecosystems. Joss and Tessa are here today to hopefully shed some light on what responsible tourism really means and how the super yacht industry can learn from And Beyond's journey. Thank you both so much for joining me today. Where are you joining me from?
I'm in the UK, unfortunately, still, in the red zone, but Tessa is somewhere else.
Yes, I'm joining today from our head office in Johannesburg, which is head office for Africa Foundation and Beyond. A little bit far from the ocean for my liking, but that's one of the knock-on effects of COVID at the moment.
Joss, perhaps you can maybe start by explaining a bit more about the And Beyond journey and how it aims to bring together luxury tourism and conservation.
Certainly. I mean, in a way, I think this whole COVID crisis has just flagged again that And Beyond, or what used to be called the Conservation Corporation, was way ahead of its time in that it espoused full impact model around sustainability that's now becoming normal and what people are demanding now. But fundamentally, it's on three pillars of looking after the land or ocean, the care of the land and ocean, care of the people, which is both staff and the communities, and there's lots of crossover between the two. So we put both of those under people, and then care of the wildlife. And so those are the three pillars that we are built on. It's all paid for and self-sustaining through profits generated from tourism activities. So unlike most NGOs or conservation companies that are looking for third-party grants or funding or are underwritten by wealthy philanthropists, that's not And Beyond. What we generate, we put back into these three platforms. And the guests who stay with us are a really critical part of the whole model, which we'll talk about later when it comes to super yachts and what we think could be done there. So we focus on biosphere preservation, whether it's on land or large-scale marine ecosystems, empowerments of local communities, and fundamentally reversal of local extinctions. Pangolin, rhino, lion, cheetah, jaguar, dolphin, whales, turtles. That's And Beyond.
And you mentioned rhinos there. Rhinos Without Borders was obviously kind of a big part of the And Beyond journey, certainly when you first came on my radar. Can you explain a bit more about that project and how it worked?
Yeah, that spoke to the reversal of local extinctions. Obviously, there was large-scale poaching in South Africa, and we're one of the largest owners of private white rhino in the world. And so we felt we needed to do something to protect the species, which was to airlift them to Botswana, into the Okavango Delta. And so we set about going into a partnership with another company called Great Plains Conservation and raising a bunch of money to move the target with 100 rhino from South Africa, from our reserves, into Botswana. So walk forward 5-6 years, and we raised all the money. We moved 87 rhino before lockdown from COVID. Those 87 rhinos have given birth to 64 progeny. So we've never got across the line on the 100, but I'd say we're across the line in totem. So it was a great project, and we learned a lot about breaking down the walls between competing conservation companies in the greater goal of reversing local extinctions. And we kind of applied that to Oceans Without Borders in our thinking and learned a lot about how to manage the expectations of competing CEO egos, always the first that get in the way of everything, right down to money, to operations, how to get teams to work together. But fundamentally, it was every decision point was if it was in the best interest of the rhino, then it was a decision that we took. And it's been a great success.
And do you find that a lot of conservation projects get a bit trapped in very specific areas or specific countries?
Yes, very much so. We did albeit on websites about 2 years ago, we scanned how many conservation companies there are for individual species. And it was fascinating. I'll give you some statistics. There are 150 wildlife NGOs in South Africa alone. There are 66 lodge companies across Africa that have more than five lodges, but not all of them are involved in conservation. So you've got NGOs doing it, but you don't have the people who actually benefit from it doing it. There are 12 NGOs specifically looking after dugongs in Southern Africa, and there's only probably 250 left. There are 1,000 NGOs for rhino. So that means there's one NGO for every six rhino alive on the planet. There are 24 for pangolin. There are 31 for lions, and there's 20 for cheetah. So I think the statistics kind of speak for themselves. Is if everyone's just furrowing their own and you're not fundamentally working across borders, you're not going to get anywhere fast. You're not going to scale the impact. So I think whether it was rhinos without borders or oceans without borders, one of the fundamental aims was to make sure that whatever we did was a kind of open source platform that other people could benefit or join, because I believe that's the only way you can really make these things work.
And obviously, as you mentioned there, the kind of same ethos as Rhinos Without Borders was then applied to Ocean Without Borders. Tessa, can you explain a bit more about how that works and how you've been involved?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Rhinos Without Borders, I think, was an incredibly powerful demonstration of the incredible impact for conservation that can be achieved when competitors put aside their differences and really align and join forces behind conservation action. And in the oceans, this is absolutely essential. Our oceans are our ultimate global commons. They have no boundaries. They connect us all, you know, whether it's through the atmosphere or through the oceans themselves. So everyone needs them. We all rely on them. They're responsible for 80% of the oxygen we breathe, never mind the economic resources that we draw from them. But no one truly takes, in a lot of cases, responsibility for them, because it is such a shared common. So it's this ultimate tragedy of the commons. So really applying this philosophy of joining forces across sectors, between competitors, between various different diverse stakeholder groups is absolutely essential in ocean conservation. So the lessons learned and the philosophies established during the Rhinos Without Borders journey, I think, have been incredibly valuable in transferring into the ocean space. It's actually the scale of the recognition of this need to sort of transcend boundaries and sectors it's been recognized at the highest level. So the United Nations, in terms of their Sustainable Development Goals for 2030, have particularly called for collaboration, intersectoral collaboration, to drive sustainable development and conservation goals for 2030. So at a time when the world is really recognizing the need for this new, really dynamic approach to marine conservation, the inspired leadership of And Beyond and Africa Foundation recognized this growing change, took the lessons that they'd learned from the Rhinos Without Borders journey, and forged a really functional, practical, intersectoral collaboration between And Beyond and Africa Foundation. So And Beyond is a luxury travel, as Josh said, for-profit organization, whereas Africa Foundation is a not-for-profit, largely community development-focused NGO. So completely different types of organizations, but combining forces for a very powerful common goal. And I think, you know, finding ways to make marine conservation work between these two very different entities. It's not easy. There's a reason it hasn't been done effectively in the past. But it's the place to be. You know, when you're sitting in that place of discomfort and you're figuring it out along the way, you probably know you're in the right spot. It's been an amazing journey so far, figuring out how to draw on the strengths of those two very different entities. But then beyond those two organizations as well, we have this marine footprint that again transcends boundaries. So across And Beyond's lodge space, there are currently three lodges in East Africa, and then Pinda is very close to the coast in South Africa. So across those marine lodges, we have a span of about 3,000 kilometers of East African coastline, and that spans three different countries currently. And as the footprint grows, Oceans Without Borders will grow with it. Across all of those spaces, we aim to transcend all of those boundaries that we talk about, not just political boundaries, but working with various sectors in government, with local communities, with our guests, with local NGOs, to find ways to really effectively support marine conservation. So a lot of the work is to find out what's being done already, what is happening, and rather than duplicate or compete or, you know, try and recreate anything, it's to find how we can work together, how we can collaborate, how we can put aside our differences, find our commonalities, and really drive effective marine conservation that's going to be sustainable in the long term, and not just, you know, for the length of a particular study or a particular project or a funding period, but to really build local capacity into the future.
What are some of the kind of really practical projects that Oceans Without Borders is involved in at the moment?
As I was saying, you know, it depends what's happening in the different areas. So as Joss highlighted, there are some sort of key things that get huge amounts of attention in particular places. You know, if someone's completely got that covered, then, you know, we can pick up and focus on the other bits. But the real opportunity with our marine footprint is that we have this huge span of East African coastline where we can really focus on connectivity. And a lot of those sites are in these really astounding marine coral reef ecosystems. So coral reefs form a large part of our focus. And they're probably one of the most threatened marine ecosystems on the planet. They're the canary in the cage in a lot of ways, particularly with respect to rising carbon in our atmospheres and global temperature increases. A huge focus of what we do is around coral reef ecosystems. Fundamentally, we want to make sure that across all of our sites that we have really good information about the state of those reefs. Are they healthy? Are they not? What are the problems? What are the diversity? Are there particular areas that need to be conserved? So building those really strong information baselines. And then moving up the food web as well. So looking at, you know, what are the other species on the reef looking like? So things like apex predators. So things like sharks or giant trevallies are species that we focus on quite a lot. And we have a telemetry tagging program. So we tag marine predators with an acoustic tag that has a little ping that it sends out. And then we have established receiver arrays at each of our sites. So we can track where the animal movement is happening. And by tracking those animals and seeing where they're going, we can inform how we and others can direct limited conservation resources. Because I don't know if you've ever been diving, but when you get onto a healthy reef, so something that's diverse and there's lots of fish and there's all kinds of different fish, very often that's where you're going to find the big predators. So they're using those really healthy, diverse, vibrant ecosystems. So if we can pinpoint where they're going and where those key spots are for breeding, for hosting this abundance of marine life, then we can really focus our efforts for conservation on those spaces. And in a place like East Africa and many marine ecosystems globally where resources are limited, being able to identify those spots is really important. So that's a big part of what we do. Because those species move so far, it very much requires strong regional collaboration. So we aim to work with partners all the way along the coast that can really maximize the effect of that work. Beyond that, we have turtles. They're obviously a species that gets a lot of attention in terms of conservation. But turtles have been a big part of the And Beyond Africa Foundation and Oceans Without Borders story. The turtle monitoring program on Nemba has been one of the longest standing turtle monitoring programs in the Western Indian Ocean. And the reason that exists and has been maintained for this period of time is the fact that And Beyond and Africa Foundation have had a presence there. So as Joss was saying, you know, there's this long-term self-funding model where we can really build these long-term monitoring programs, build strong relationships with communities as well, and with local stakeholders, with our staff. So really living that care of the people principle. And by having that long-term infrastructure, the long-term monitoring, and the long-term relationships, we can really support these long-term programs. So the turtles are a wonderful example of that. The same applies on Vermese. Also with other collaborators there, we've got a 20-year data set of turtles. And then moving into Benguera going forward, we're working with our partners there to begin establishing similar monitoring programs there. So those are some of our our big programs.
And what have been some of the kind of biggest challenges along the way? I guess it's a question for both of you with Oceans Without Borders.
Of course, there's large NGOs and a lot of focus now on ocean conservation, marine conservation. And obviously in the last 3 to 4 years, even pre-COVID, you know, the whole plastic story became very prevalent. But when we started Oceans Without Borders, the plastic story really wasn't that live. And ocean conservation from operators, from some NGOs within the safari sort of industry, or even the marine lodge industry on a large scale, just large scale marine conservation just wasn't an agenda. Maybe localize things in and around the specific lodge. So I guess when we draw sort of a ring around this 3,000 kilometers of coastline and said, could we as Little Land Beyond actually have an influence using these three islands as a start point? It was a big bet. Would people understand it? Would we actually be able to deliver? I had no idea. I was an armchair marine conservation. I knew nothing about it really fundamentally. And so, but I knew that the need was there. So it's been a challenge sort of just taking it on at the size and scale with a very small team. Also, I think the start point of this links back to what Bode International is kind of involved in. It was in conversations with two people that this came to fruition. It was with the team at National Geographic, who look after all the marine conservation programs globally. They just said, this area you people are in are really, really important, because I went to Washington to see them. And they said, you've got to do something if you can do it. The second was a conversation with ocean philanthropists in the UK, who said, we are funding ocean conservation, but we want to bring it to our children, the experiences when we're on our boats that they can see. Could you do this for me? I said, geez, I think I can do this, because I've been told by the best people in the world at Nat Geo that this is important. And I've been told by people who might fund it that they want something where their boats and their children can go or stay in our lodges and get involved. And I said, that's exactly what we do on land. We're just going to do it at sea. Those are the two start points. And I think they're very different from someone who might say, right, I come out of an NGO and want to do marine conservation. A little bit entrepreneurial, a bit fortuitous, but walk forward 5 years and it's great, really rewarding projects. And I genuinely think we are now actually making an impact, which is great.
And Tessa, what have been some of the kind of biggest challenges that you've come across with the project?
It was a very new space to move into, I think, for both And Beyond and Africa Foundation. So really kind of starting from the very beginning and going from scratch, okay, where do we start? Let's figure this landscape out. And then, you know, like I was saying before, not wanting to recreate or compete with anything that's happening, but rather find our niche, find how we can contribute and support in the region. So I think it's been a long process of figuring out where are the places that we can really contribute? What are the bits that we can bring that are really going to maximize the collective effort for marine conservation? So that's it's a journey in itself, but when you're doing it across, you know, remote parts of East Africa, across very diverse cultures, language groups, political systems, sometimes in very remote areas. You know, the Northern Mozambican Channel, which is one of the really special sites that Joss was talking about. You know, it's got the highest diversity of corals and reef fish and life outside of the coral triangle, which is incredibly significant. But to get there is no mean feat. Never mind run a hospitality operation or marine conservation or try and start a whole new entity. So, you know, it was a challenge figuring out, how do we make this happen? How do we do it? And then looking at what are the resources that we need? You know, can we run this entirely through lodges or through our Africa Foundation teams? How do we need to structure this thing? What is the infrastructure in place? Have we got enough boats to do this? Have we got research equipment? It's become a whole new beast of its own, way beyond anything that existed beforehand. So that was a long journey. But then I think, you know, we were just getting momentum with that. And then, like, it's over a year now that we've been grappling with the COVID crisis. So just as we were really kind of finding our steam, finding our stride, COVID definitely put a big speed bump in the road, made things very logistically challenging, particularly in the hospitality industry as well.
And Joss, Tessa obviously there touched on COVID. Presumably it's been a tough 18 months for you.
2,000 people in And Beyond and Oceans Without Borders and the Africa Foundation know it's been hell. And we're still not through it, is the inconvenient truth. But I think the impact it's had is obviously it's been dramatic. You can't get into the field. Tessa's the longest she's been out of the ocean since she was a baby, I think. My wife yesterday said, you know, how are you actually coping? You know,
my gills are very dry.
Very dry. You know, for literally 40 years, I've been on plane every month since I was tiny, just traveling. And I haven't moved for 14 months. But that's the least of our issues, I think, in terms of actually being able to execute and the impact it's had. You know, many of our resources have turned to basically frontline relief work. We're more like the International Red Cross than a marine conservation NGO. You know, food packages, solar lamps, absolute clinical treatments for frontline communities who've got no income anymore. So it's been pretty disastrous, and I don't think we really understood the huge impact of it. Obviously, on the positive side of it all, to a degree, some of the oceans have been able to recover around Nember Island. Just the reduction of traffic has helped for a short period of time. It's given us room to really think what we want to do, you know, within Oceans Without Borders and put teams onto the islands. We've staffed up quite a lot, oddly. The one bit of And Beyond that's grown is Oceans Without Borders. Everything else has stayed the same because we can just see the need and the impact it's having. And I do think that COVID long term, you've got to look past what we're doing now and say, where are we trying to get to? And I really strongly think it is going to accelerate all of the things we've been saying, whether it's on land or in sea. We've been saying for a long time, less volume of people, higher value, integrated, empowered communities and shared value economics with communities, proper data and research to support all of our projects, whether they're on land and sea. All of that's falling into place. And so I do think that there's a window of opportunity here for us to tell this story even louder. We've got a loud halo and we shouldn't miss it. If we're just focusing on the negative, that's not going to get us anywhere. So to a degree, I'd like to think we're just stepping hard forward into it rather than reversing up as a result of it.
So do you think COVID will fundamentally change the way your guests feel about travel?
Yes, we're already on that journey already. I think it's accelerated it. You could do it by demographic. You could do it by geography less, but more by demographic. You know, millennials, the millennial age group was rising as a portion of our guests. It's accelerated quite quickly, and they are very demanding in terms of sustainability credentials, proper sustainability credentials, and buying decisions around proper impact. So to a degree, we don't have to do anything more than we're doing, but we're seeing more of that come through in terms of forward inquiries. The great thing is that across every age group, we're seeing that demand as well, driven by our impact credentials, where people are making choices and talking to us because they say this matters to us now. The second one is that they are going for longer to shorter durations. So we've been jumping up and down for years saying, why is it that guests have ADHD? Yeah, they jump around two nights. They'll go to the Maldives for 14 days and sit on a sun lounge. But when it actually comes to getting involved in the experiential conservation sustainability agenda of real field experiences with their children, it's jumping around a lot and it gets very difficult to tell that story. I guess the other thing that's working in our favor is they're saying, fine, look, we're going to calm down. We want to go 4 nights, 5 nights here. Let's go deep in that destination. Teach us. Then we'll go to another one. Go 5 days. Go deep. Teach us. We're like, thank goodness. That's what we've been trying to do for a while. So that's a positive change. How long that lasts, I don't know. But I think both of those are positive changes. On the negative, we've got a lot less guests than we would want. And so we need things to open up again.
So I guess coming back to kind of the main reason why we're talking, what do you think the super industry can learn from the And Beyond model moving forwards?
So, I mean, I think as Joss was just saying about immersing our guests in these wild environments where, you know, spend time, immerse yourself, feel these places, get to understand them and learn. And I think the super yacht industry, it places people in remote corners of the world that, you know, very few get to access, which is, you know, similar to what And Beyond offers its guests. And being able to access those remote corners of the world, it's a if you allow people to immerse in those environments, it can only affect them emotionally, at an emotional level. And I think that's when change really happens. When people are immersed in these environments that just, they astound you, they inspire you. And when you're feeling that sort of energy, you know, and that sort of emotional response to an environment, then you're motivated to make change. You can get all the information you want off the internet, and, you know, it might go in at a cerebral level, but when it really hits your gut, you know, when you're in these big blue spaces or on these huge ocean expanses or there's whales breaching next to your boat, you know, that's when you feel the real drive to make a difference. And so I think combining powerful messaging and powerful education into the experience of being on these yachts in these amazing environments, I think is an important component of what the experiences should entail on these vessels around the world. And then obviously a lot of the people that are accessing these environments and accessing these boats are people with incredible means and influence on the planet. So by offering those sorts of people and those guests and those that sector of society, by putting up the challenge of, you know, how are you going to do better in the world? How are you going to live better in the world? How are you going to run your companies better? You can really drive change at the sort of level that it needs to happen for ocean conservation, because it really has to. Our oceans are at a stage where it requires high level change, and the superyacht industry, I think, has an incredible ability to influence change at that scale. And then I think the other one, obviously they're a wonderful platform for science and for citizen science and data collection and mapping of our oceans and all those wonderful things that I know boat facilitates quite directly, which is phenomenal. But I also think one of the key changes that could happen is the driving of innovation for sustainability, because yachts are, you know, they're these incredible, I've spent years on a yacht myself in the past, and they're these spaces where you really need to, everything is so purpose driven and designed, the engineering is amazing, and there's the resources in that industry to really drive innovation and engineering. And if that's focused around sustainability and finding better ways to live on the planet, to harness energy, to process waste, to get ourselves around the planet, whatever it may be, if we can really push that agenda of pushing the edge of engineering for sustainability through that industry, I think that's something that the superyacht industry could absolutely contribute at a much greater scale to society and globally to sustainability.
Very much agree with that. Great saying that no man or woman is an island. Sometimes these superyachts are islands and they shouldn't be. Just because you're untethered and roaming doesn't mean you're not responsible. And I think when you look at the entire returns, and I mean that in a broad sense, because obviously you've got superyacht owners who use it for their own enjoyment and their own experiences, and there's a return on life, yeah, that you get from their boats. No one's trying to take that away from them. And then obviously you've got the charter market where, you know, there's financial returns based on renting out those platforms to other people to cover your costs and do all those things. But when you look at all of the entire returns, you can't take and not give back at the same time. And I think the superyacht industry and superyachts, as Tess just said, are perfectly placed to be able to do great good and give back in abundance, from citizen science on the boats to exposing younger generations to marine science through those platforms, to sustainable technology being developed. I mean, I look at Formula One and Formula E, which is obviously the electric version of Formula One, and Extreme E, which has just been launched. So there you've got a direct, exact sort of parallel, same kind of universe, and they've transitioned really hard. There's not an if or a but, it's just we're going to go Extreme E and we're going to do Formula E. And you've got Lewis Hamilton driving an Extreme E, and he's saying, I'm in. I think there's a great opportunity for the superyacht industry to go the same direction and to be a really meaningful part of marine conservation and have fun at the same time as well. It's not to forget all the fun. That's the whole point of owning these things, right? And I guess within And Beyond, we try very hard to make that balance, make it meaningful. meaningful, make it impactful, make it a learning platform, and make it really fun. Do that, you can achieve all of those objectives.
Because do you think having guests more involved with, you know, particularly looking at the charter, having guests more involved on board in marine conservation could actually enhance their experience? Is that what you see with guests at and beyond?
100%. Give people, you don't want to shove it down their throats either. Of course, someone's chartered a boat and they want to have fun. But if it's done in a gentle way where it's meaningful and it's kind of weaved into the experience, that's how we do it in the lodges. We have these impact journeys, which are specific conservation-based experiences. But in every day, through the ranger or the guide or the tracker or the lodge teams, they're exposed to our conservation work, whether it's through a lecture, whether it's live in the field, whether it's on a boat diving on Nemba or Benguera, you get, and is, are you, oh, so you're interested in the data conservation around coral. Why don't you come out this afternoon and collect some with us or go measure with us? And from that, you go, well, do you want to see our live data website where we collate everything so you can see it across all sites? You can do it in a gentle way, but I have got no question at all that in terms of adding to a meaningful experience, if it's done in the right way, it will not only improve the experience, it will transform it.
And do you think yachts could also be doing more in terms of the data they're sharing? I guess maybe this is a question more for you, Tessa. You know, you mentioned that they're going and they're charting, they're seeing the coral. Do you think there could be more in terms of sharing of that information?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these days, and I think, you know, COVID, it's one of the silver linings of COVID is that we've all been forced to become very proficient in the digital space. So the information sharing platforms on our planet have become, you know, they've been fast-tracked significantly in the last 18 months, I think. And increasingly, there are these data sharing platforms. So, for example, the Allen Coral Atlas program is, you know, a global mapping of coral reefs. And then all of the, and this is, you know, I'm obviously a little bit passionate about coral reefs. It's my particular thing. But, you know, wherever those yachts are traveling, whatever information they're collecting, whether it's just running a sonar over the bottom and collecting mapping information, whether it's seeing, hey, we saw a school of 50 spinner dolphins this morning, here's the GPS location, put it in a database, you know, whatever it is, all of that information can so easily be fed into these platforms these days. So Allen Coral Atlas is one of the really well-established ones that I can sort of use as an example. And the maps just get better and better the more information that goes into them. So they exist, and then as boats move around, people feed information in, mapping comes, you go, hey, actually, you know, this is not a seagrass area, this is a coral area, or actually, you know what, this is not a lagoon, the whole bottom is covered in seagrass. It's like that, and the better the information is that's going into those maps, the better the tool becomes for supporting and driving conservation and research. So there's a huge amount that can be done. I mean, with And Beyond, Africa Foundation and Oceans Without Borders, we are working on a platform at the moment that integrates all of these things. It's a digital platform, we call it Beyond the Sighting, and it's around collecting all the information that our guides see when they're out driving in the bush, or our dive masters see when they're driving to dive sites. Whatever those observations are, log them into the database, and it can be a fantastic two-way experiential learning experience as well, because the information's going into those digital databases. But with the sorts of beautiful front-end designs that we can have these days, it's a wonderful experience for guests to be able to see that data become a story. So in Pinda Game Reserve, for example, there's, you know, some of those cheetah or rhinos or elephants, they're individuals that are known now. So if you put your data point and you see, oh, this is this guy and he's been hanging around this particular waterhole, and it's maybe because there's a lady around the corner that he's particularly interested in, or whatever it is, or pods of dolphins that you suddenly see, oh geez, these guys are actually coming around the same kind of time every year, that's interesting, I wonder if I should plan my next holiday to see if they're there again. There's all sorts of feedback loops, and it becomes, the data becomes alive, and there are so many tools for that these days that it can really be a very it's not just about yachts collecting data to put them into databases for scientists. It's about mapping the story of the places that you're moving in, that you're interacting in, that you're engaging in. And then it becomes far more meaningful because you understand them better. And I think the digital space really brings that alive these days. So there's lots that can be tapped into.
And Joss, I guess kind of coming back to our core point, there's some people that would say sustainability and tourism can never work together, or, you know, that they're not something that can exist. What would you say to those critics?
Absolute rubbish. And I don't think even before COVID, I would disagree. Now I say it can't not coexist. Otherwise, there won't be a tourism industry. It just simply won't happen. And they can fully coexist. So, I mean, at Ambient, you know, our average nightly rate, I wish I could get super yacht rates for our lodges, but they're high enough. You know, we're at $1,000 per person per night, which is really expensive. So we're definitely at the very high end of the luxury tourism industry. And yet, I think if you take a look at our website and go onto our impact review and actually look at our impact credentials and our achievements in terms of sustainability delivery, they're very, very high and they're industry leading, from plastic eradication to wastewater management, to local procurement, to local employment, community empowerment, community development. We touch on all of them, and we're proud of them. Ducking that question is the short way out, because either people don't want to do it, the operators, or even pre-COVID, there are some guests who just aren't interested in that, and that's fine. I'm just saying, I think they're in a minority now. And I think any responsible operator who wants to operate in our sphere can only do it responsibly, because otherwise we're going nowhere.
So I guess ending on a positive note, what would your hope be for luxury tourism in the future?
As I said, I think there's a really great opportunity post-COVID to push the whole agenda here. It can be sustainable. It can be done. It can be really enjoyable. It can be non-consumptive to a degree. If you look at everything that we're trying to do on carbon now and the direction we're taking on carbon as a world, and just to climate change, ocean carbon, etc., I think the whole world's pushing in that direction. And I think there is a sustainable future. And who doesn't want to live in a world where you get out and you get onto a boat, even a small one, take that little dinghy, you know, even a Macora, little dugout in the Okavango Delta is as meaningful experience as sitting on a 200-foot super yacht. It is. But they're not mutually exclusive. And I guess what I'd urge is the people on those super yachts are as important as the person sitting a dugout in the Okavango Delta to tell that story and be responsible for it. And to have crews who are proud to take guests, you know, under the decks to look at the solar technology, to look at the wastewater treatment plant. Once you've got that, it becomes a positive story. It doesn't become an and, you know, a CSR thing that sits on the side. You have to tick these boxes. We hate that. That doesn't actually achieve anything. And certainly for the people working in it, it's not a fun and positive way to lead your life. So, you know, I guess for the Ambienters, I'd like to think, in fact, I know that for a lot of them, that's the reason they come to work for us every day, for exactly what we've talked about. So I think they belong together.
Tessa, for you, what's your hope for kind of the future of the world's oceans? There's so much doom and gloom at the moment. Do you have some positivity in there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the awareness that has grown and the collective action that's been taken over the past sort of 5 to 10 years is incredibly inspiring. The fact that there has been such an incredible uptake on Oceans Without Borders over the past 4 years is just remarkable. It really speaks to the fact that there's a growing awareness, there's growing recognition that the future of our planet, all of our futures, very literally is directly reliant on our oceans. And I think this era of global information is very powerful in driving that. There are a couple of examples, like Joss highlighted the plastic issue. And, you know, a few images, powerful images of turtles with a plastic straw up their nose, and it has mobilized the way we do business on the planet. You know, there's the big corporations are going, how do we deal with plastics? We've changed the way restaurants, you know, taking away plastic bags and plastic straws. I mean, 10 years ago, people would have laughed at you. Those are basic conveniences that we use in our everyday life. These days, there's hardly anyone that would argue that either is a bad idea. So I think change is possible, and there's very strong change happening in the ocean space. There's massive growing awareness. The uptake is incredibly powerful. So I think we're sitting in a time of real opportunity. We're in a time of real danger of getting it wrong, but it's a time of incredible opportunity to change our futures and to really mobilize the high level change that needs to happen, because it's huge. And being part of that change, I think, is incredibly exciting, and being able to play a role in that. And I think the vehicle we have, you know, particularly because it's quite unique, being this interesting partnership and operating in all these interesting spaces where we have lots of quite unique relationships and collaborators to work with, it's exciting, and it's the change that needs to happen, and it's great to be part of that.
I think Shackleton said, optimism is the truest form of moral courage.
Well, let's end on that note and be hopeful. Thank you so much. It's been so thought-provoking as to both how superyachts and luxury tourism more generally could be doing more for ocean conservation and sustainability. So thank you both so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sophia. Thank you, Jess.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and Grace Nielsen. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.